Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with actor Colin Lane. Colin has done everything that you can do as an actor. He's been above the title on Broadway, off Broadway, off Broadway. He's worked in regional theaters and in movies. And luckily for us, he is currently co-starring with Susan Greenhill in Chapati, a touching, funny, quirky romance, running at Florida Studio Theater until May 1st. Colin's story is interesting because he didn't intend to think about, plan to, be interested in being an actor. And yet, that is clearly what he is. So listen to this charming, funny man tell the story of how he arrived at the, quote, one thing he can actually do, unquote.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you should be. Not the person your parents told you you had to be. Not the person your spouse seems to like. Not the person that your friends are. Not the person that somehow fits your idea of what a person should be. But who you really are. As I have been describing all of the ways in which people pretend to be somebody they're not, did this strike a chord with you? Do you remember being told by your family that you should or shouldn't be or do or say or think something? Do you remember being a teenager and trying desperately to be somebody you hoped would bring you the friends you wanted, the boyfriend or girlfriend you wanted, wishing that you were somehow different from the person that you seem to be, and trying, really, to be different in some way? And today, do you second-guess yourself? Do you wait to hear what someone else thought about the book that you two read, or the movie you've seen, or the clothes in the store window before you venture to say what you think? In fact, do you even know what you think and need to wait to hear what someone else thinks? Are you pretending to be someone you're not? Unfortunately, so many people come out of childhood with taboos about something that's natural to them. How you speak, how you laugh, how you dress, what you look like, what you're interested in, your sexual orientation. All of these things can come in for criticism. And if you are not exactly what everybody else is, maybe they're pretending too, who knows, or if you are not exactly what your family wanted, and they let you know that that in some way is not all right, we can pretend and then finally forget that it is pretending and think that we are those things we had pretended to be and lose access to who we really are. This is really unfortunate because, to begin with, a lot of those things are wonderful that you gave up. Many of them have energy attached to them, which you are now suppressing. And if that weren't enough, if you deny something about yourself, pretend that you're not it, even if you've forgotten that you are it, you feel like there's something wrong with you, even if you don't know exactly what it is. And it's terrible to go through life like that. As a psychotherapist, I see all the time the damage that has been done to people who have decided very young that something about them didn't work or wasn't all right, or was going to bring them criticism or even punishment, and then dedicated their life to eradicating something about themselves. This does not lead to happy life. But as a therapist, I also know that we can recover what we have been forced to deny. Of course, psychotherapy is one of the ways to do that. So if anything that I have said strikes a chord with you, please think about going into psychotherapy to recover yourself and live a more happy, joyous, and free life, which I believe is everybody's birthright. If you want to talk to me about any of this, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And up there on my website, you can click on Email Me, ask me any questions. You can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. You might be interested in the book I wrote, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. This speaks to why it's so difficult to change, and as I say in the title, what you can do about it. Up there on my website, you can also listen to every show I have ever done. They're all up there in podcast, including the interview that I am about to air with the dramatic Colin Lane. And Colin's story is the story of a man who actually followed himself. Whatever it seemed right for him to do, he did, even though quite a lot of that got him into hot water. It's a delightful story, which has a delightful ending. And the current ending is Colin appearing in the regional premiere production of Christopher O'Reilly's delightful play, Chapati, which is running at Florida Studio Theater. And also, I'm reading a review of Chapati by Sharon Leslie. So right now, here is Colin Lane. So I'm here with Colin Lane. And Colin is here in a play called Chapati, which he shares the stage with Susan Greenhill, who is amazing. And Colin is truly wonderful. It's a wonderful performance.
Thanks.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And Claire, you make your living, your life with the art of acting. Would that be appropriate to say?
That's very true, yes. It's the only thing I can do. I can't do anything else.
No. Well, luckily for you then, you've found this thing you can do.
Yes, I am fortunate in that way.
Okay, so I ask only one question.
Okay.
And that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when you thought, performing, acting, having people look at me, telling stories, any of that? Do you remember?
Well, I have a bit of a family background in the business. My mother was a singer. And her brother was known as Ireland's Al Jolson.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Blackface
and that. And my grandfather meddled in the, you know.
Meddled?
Yeah, he wanted to be an actor, but he was dissuaded from it. But he did amateur. And sometimes at Christmas, the pantos and stuff like that. He played the wolf in Red Riding Hood, you know, and stuff like that.
This would be your mother's and your uncle's father?
Yeah, yeah.
So that side of the family, anyway, had lots of...
Yeah, and so we often did skits and stuff like that, you know.
In the house?
In the house, but in the parish, you know, that sort of thing, you know.
So when did you, I mean, so does that mean they said, oh, we'll bring little Colin along, or?
Yeah, we were, my sister and I, we played the kids in anything they did, you know.
You played the kids, that's very appropriate.
Yeah.
So how young were you when you played the first kid?
I was probably about 7 or 8.
So you're 7.
Yeah.
And your mother or grandfather or uncle says, we're going to do this panto and we want you to come along?
No. My mother now would have been, she was a singer. They used to do musicals and stuff like that.
Right.
And we would play the kids if they needed kids.
Okay. So do you remember the first time you did that?
I remember my first line.
Yes.
And it was, Granda's dead. But we cried.
Yes, and you cried, right?
Yeah.
Oh God.
Oh my God. And but when I went away to boarding school, it being all boys, the young boys played girls.
Mm-hmm.
And they had different scenes in the shows, and I like to call it the Italian scene, where everyone was dressed like an Italian, you know, from the 19th century or something like that, and the Hawaiian scene where you got to wear a grass skirt and stuff. And I remember bribing a guy, because I wanted to wear that grass skirt. I remember bribing a guy with candy to let me go on to call him sick. Because I wanted to wear it. And in the Italian scene, I have a picture actually on my phone I showed you. I have this picture. I have this picture of me as an Italian girl.
As an Italian girl.
Yeah.
Yes.
And at the time, I was crazy about this girl in Dublin, you know, who lived across the street from me. She was 14 and I was 12. There was no hope, you know. But I showed her this picture.
In an attempt to woo her.
I don't know why. But I showed her this picture. And, right. And you know, and she said, and all these are boys dressed as girls? And I said, yeah, Deirdre, yeah. Her name was Deirdre McCall. Yeah. And she points at me and she says, that's definitely a girl. And I felt like the ground opened up. And that was it.
So you didn't say no.
No, I didn't say that's me, you know.
No. So, did you have a yearning for this, or an interest in this, or?
I mean, people watching me.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
So when did you discover that? Do you know? I mean, so when your mother said, we're doing this play and we need some kids, you were all for it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I never thought twice about it.
No.
Yeah.
And did it feel like an exciting thing, or it was just...
Yeah.
Things that normal.
No, it felt exciting.
Yeah. Okay, so then, how old did you go away to boarding school?
12.
12. And where was the drama society? Was that in boarding school?
No, that was University College Dublin.
Oh, that's later. That's later. Okay,
yeah.
So you go off to boarding school at 12.
Yeah.
And you're the Italian girl and you're the Hawaiian girl.
Yeah. I ran away because I was in love with Deirdre McLaughlin.
Really? Yes, I see it.
Yeah.
So you ran away?
I ran away. Then.
You ran home?
I ran home, yeah.
You ran home from the boarding school?
The boarding school was on the border with Northern Ireland.
Ah, ooh.
And I had, the currency at the time was shillings and pence, if you remember. And I had 2 7 pence on me. And I ran 4 miles along a country road, along a fjord, in Carnifford Lock, and... diving into ditches when I'd see it, because it was winter, and it was dark at 4 o'clock, and I'd see cars coming for miles, and I'd jump into the ditch, and then I got the bus in Carlingford to Dundalk, which is the main town, and it was 2 and 5, and so I had tuppence left. I bought a platform ticket for the train, and I got on the train. I wasn't supposed to. You could buy a platform ticket to say somebody to goodbye to someone.
Oh, like a platform ticket isn't a seat.
No, it's just tuppence. And then I locked myself in the john, and I was found, you know, the guard, the ticket collector, kept knocking on the door and saying, come on.
Wow. So what happened?
He put me in the guard, whatever it is they have on the train in the room, and when we got to Dublin, he called up my father, and my father came down and picked me up, and my father didn't say a word. That was like, it was chilling. But my mother kicked me around the table.
Oh,
literally
really?
Kicked me around the
really?
Table.
Because they wanted you to go there? They wanted you to...
Yeah, because it was screwing up the life now, you know. This is the middle of... It was the middle of a term, and what was I going to do?
I
told them I was not going back there, you know. It's notorious. I was the only guy to ever run away from the place, and the place is now closed.
Really?
Yeah, the IRA vacation there now.
Was it a bad place?
No, it wasn't a bad place at all. It was just that I wasn't emotionally right for it. You know?
Yeah. Okay, so you went home. They didn't really want to have you there.
No.
So now you're a big 13 years old. So what happens?
I went to, I got into a school, Sandymount High School took me in the middle of the term. And it was terrible.
Terrible?
It was terrible. I was kept getting sent home to have my hair cut.
Have your hair cut?
Yeah.
Because you let it grow too long?
Well, it wasn't even long by that, but it was just...
It's a punishment.
Yeah, yeah. I would be sent home 3 or 4 times a week to get my hair cut.
This is their punishment, is a haircut?
Yeah, yeah. And
and they didn't cut it, they sent you home, so that your parents would know that you were a bad boy?
Yeah.
I see.
And then I would, and then I eventually got kicked out of school because I had my hair, what didn't satisfy them. But I wasn't going to go back anyway. I went down to the local high school, and I pleaded with the brother in charge. I said, I'll be the best student you ever, honest to God, I won't be a troublemaker, I won't do anything. I just need you to have faith in me. And he said, okay. And I went there, and it was the time of my life. It was a great class. We were the first class to graduate. In that school, there were only 18 of us. And because people didn't go to, second level, didn't finish second level.
Really?
Yeah. And we were the first class. There were 18 of us, and we were really an interesting bunch. We led discussions and this, that, and the other.
So you finally found a place that you fit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you were what, 15?
I was 15, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And the class was filled with poets and actors. Patrick Bergen was in the class. Mm-hmm. He's a well-known Irish actor. And the brother of an Abbey actor, Emmett Bergen. And guys writing poetry and...
Was it all boys?
All boys, yeah. Photographers and a champion table tennis player, too. ranked. Interestingly enough, looked Chinese.
Really?
Yeah. I thought that was funny. Ping pong, you know, the Chinese and ping pong.
Oh.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, so in all of this bouncing around until you could find a place where you actually fit, did you have any aspirations to be an actor? Did that occur to you? Did you know?
The only ambition I had when I was growing up that I'm aware of, really, I mean, I enjoyed being on stage now whenever I got the chance, but...
Did you get many chances?
No, I didn't. But the only ambition I had was to get served a pint in a pub.
To be old enough?
Yeah. Well, no, not to be old enough, because we didn't carry IDs, you just had to look 18.
Oh, well, to look old enough too,
right? Yeah,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, that was all.
That was it, you're aiming at being served a pint?
Yeah.
Well, you're pretty tall now, were you tall for your age?
I was always tall, yeah.
Yeah, so did you make it before the appropriate...
Yeah, 15.
15?
Yeah.
15,
yeah.
Oh God, you were still sort of, I don't know, a free spirit kind of, no?
I think I had a taste for some, you know, for some kind of elan.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. So, okay, so you graduate with these 18 other interesting guys.
Yeah.
And then do you all go on to university?
I didn't go on for 2 years. I went to London. I got a job in the bank. But then I soon left that.
Yes, I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
they wanted you to cut your hair.
I guess so. I mean, it was...
Why did you get a job in a bank?
Because it was safe, and it was considered prestigious.
Yes.
I was working in the General Bank of the Netherlands, Algemene Bank of the Netherlands.
That's interesting, because we have this young man who doesn't fit in a lot of conventional settings and doesn't suffer them either. You know, I mean, run away from here, you get thrown out from there. You're just not a really conventional kind of regular guy. And then you graduate from high school and you get a safe job. It just seems ironic.
Well, I didn't have it for very long. I left and I became a road sweeper.
A what? A road sweeper?
Yeah, for the City of London. And I ended up sweeping outside the bank I used to work
at. Did you like that?
Well, yeah, it was a great job.
That's right.
It was terrific. And, you know, we wore this little denim uniform thing with the crest of the City of London. You know how London's in boroughs?
Uh-huh.
The City of London is a borough.
Uh-huh.
It has its own crest, and it's the financial area. It's Threadneedle Street, Throgmorton Lane, you know, the Stock Exchange, the Bank of England. That. And
very high class.
Yeah, well,
yes.
I mean, there we were, sweeping. And wearing our little caps with like something out of Dickens and Oliver, Dickens, yeah. And we had a little denim jacket with the crest, and tourists would take a picture.
People would look at you.
Yeah. And the thing was, it was a real easy job.
I'll bet it was.
Because we punched in at 6 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
and you go out. You're supposed to go out at 6:30, but everyone went out at 7. And it was too busy to sweep. You get knocked down. So you waited around until the traffic lessened, until the rush hour was over.
Oh, my God.
And then you swept. And then in the afternoon, you punched out at 3 o'clock and...
went for a pint.
You hid your broom and you went and sightsee there. You went to the, somewhere else. One guy, and some of the regulars, we weren't regulars. We were taken on as... summer students,
mm-hmm.
and but some of the regulars used to punch in and go to other jobs.
Especially when they had summer students to do the sweeping.
Yeah, right. It was a great job, and it paid more than the bank.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
Well, okay. So how long did you keep that?
Well, it was summer.
Summer. Okay.
Yeah. And
all
then
right.
I went to Spain to teach English with a friend of mine.
Uh huh. You went to teach English. I think that's very funny. I'm sorry. They're in Spain, they're all speaking English with an Irish accent.
Yeah, that's true.
But was this your idea to go to Spain?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So, all this time, you're not thinking about being an actor?
No.
It's pretty amazing.
No, it's only when I go to college in Dublin.
And why did you go to college in Dublin?
Well, I don't know.
It was just the next thing to do.
Yeah, it's just the next thing to do.
And they let you in?
Yeah.
Given your checkered history?
Yeah. You make me sound like I'm not that bad.
I don't think it's bad at all. I think it's great.
Yeah.
It's just not regular or conventional or too routine. Do you think so?
I suppose not. I suppose not. But there's more.
I can't wait. Okay, good. All right, so why did you go to college? Oh, because it was the next thing to do. You didn't know what else to do.
Be a school teacher or something like that. Yeah.
School teacher?
Yeah.
Or something like that, right? Okay, so did you have to major in something?
I had, I studied Gaelic and history and English.
Very useful.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but you, and then you became part of the Drama Society.
I saw a production in London when I was there of a play called Mr. Joyce is Leaving Paris. And it moved me. It was about James Joyce.
Mm.
It moved me. I think I saw it about 5 times.
Wow.
Yeah. And I loved the acting in it. And I loved it. I loved the humor in it. And everything about it. So when I came to UCD, University College Dublin, I joined the Dramsoc so I could direct that play. And also have a social life too. Do you know Gabriel Byrne?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he and I are from the same part of Dublin where we were sort of friends, you know. He was at least a few years older than me, but we were altar boys together. And when he was doing his teaching certificate at University College of Dublin, I was a freshman there, mm-hmm. and we used to get the same bus in. And I was a member of the Dramatic Society. There wasn't a drama department, it was just a society. I remember on the bus with him once, he said, "What are you doing at Dramsoc?" I said, "Gabriel, sex, drugs, and rock and roll." The next time I saw him, yeah.
And then you're in the Drama Society, and what happened?
That Jim Sheridan was the artistic director of him. Uh-huh. Jim, my left foot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's an Oscar winner. Well, everyone knows he's a genius, and he's inner city Dublin, and he's very down to earth. And his brother Peter is in it. He's a writer, an Irish writer now. But Jim is like, talks like that, you know, he scratches his arse and his head at the same time, you know. And I don't know. I remember I met him on 9th Avenue in New York once, and he was, did you ever see his movie Coming to America?
No.
About the family, the living, well, it's about them. And it was around the time that Neil Jordan, Mona Lisa, the movie Mona Lisa came out, and Neil Jordan, who was a member of the Dramatic Society, had directed it. Mm-hmm. And he was saying to me, "Hey, Colin, do you see Neil guy in there? See Neil? Oh, fucking Jesus! I brought him into the Dramsoc." He said, "Oh, he would, but well, now look at him. He's a fucking director of films and everything." And what am I? And I said to him, "Jim, what's that in your pocket there? What have you got in your pocket?" He had a big overcoat and he had a wad of paper. He said, "It's you know, remember Christy Brown? You know, Down All the Days. You know, Christy Brown was the writer." Mm-hmm. He wrote, and he painted with his foot, his left foot, my left foot.
Right.
Yeah. Remember, it's just that, it's just a script, an adaptation of my left foot. The thing won an Oscar. he's bitching about Neil Jordan, Mona Lisa. Yeah. But he was head of the that was long after. I mean, we were stateside then. But he was head of the Dramatic Society, and he was doing a production of Oedipus Rex. And I auditioned for it. And I got cast as one of the chorus members or something like that. But it was a lot of fun. It was a modern interpretation. And it was paralleled Northern Ireland, which was exploding at the time. And in fact, when we were doing this living theatre kind of thing, Oedipus, 200,000 people, just three blocks down from where we were performing, were burning down the British Embassy.
Oh, my God.
You know, it was like, what are we doing this for? Something is happening in the street. But it was a terrible time. It was an awful time. And I, because of the troubles, you know, the forced pub crawls, you know, you go into a bar and there's an alert, you know, there's a package there or something, like there's a car outside that has a strange thing, you know, car bombs and stuff.
Right.
So it was just a miserable time. So after my first year...
Well, wait a minute. So you do Oedipus.
Yeah.
And even then, are you thinking actor or you're still not?
All I'm thinking is girls.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got it. Nothing has changed since you're 12.
No. Nothing has changed at all, to be honest.
Okay, good. Yeah. So it's Oedipus, and everything is blowing up around you.
Yeah.
And you're still in college.
And I'm in college, yeah.
And so then what?
Then I did a few more plays there that year. Phoenix Too Frequent by Christopher Fry and something else. Oh, I did Salome, Wild Salome.
And still, you're still, it's just, you're just putting one foot in front of the other.
And then I came here for the summer.
Came where?
I came to the States to work for the summer on Cape Cod.
To do what?
Making pizza. I'd never had a pizza before. I heard there was a one pizza place in Dublin at the time, but I didn't know where it was.
How did you get a job at where in...
On Cape Cod.
In Cape Cod. How did you get a job in Cape Cod making pizza?
A lot of Irish students come to the States for the summer, and word of mouth.
I see. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're on Cape Cod making pizza. I don't know, you're still a kid. I mean, so that's what you did all summer, no?
Yeah, and you know, I fell in love with the States. I really didn't want to. I didn't fancy coming here, but when I came here, I just didn't want to go back.
Do you know why?
Well, I fell in love with my wife, and I fell in love with the country. I just loved it here.
So you met your wife here in that summer?
No, I met my wife that Christmas. I had my visa extended, and I met her at a Christmas party on Beacon Hill in Boston. And that's a funny story too, because I was with this friend of mine. I was a rower in college, and I was with this friend of mine who had graduated in architecture, Frank Kenny, and he was a rower too. So we used to hang out around together in Boston, and we were coming from Hartford from a 21st birthday party where we'd been up all night drinking and playing darts, and to this party at the Society of Friends on Beacon Hill, Quaker Park.
Yes.
In where I lived. And it was their annual Christmas party. And we walked in and we saw these two American chicks, you know, sitting on the trunk waiting for the John. And they were real American. They were ski sweaters on, and they had blonde frizzy hair and jeans and ski boots, that are climbing boots, you know, that's that look. And I said to Frank, because Frank was the brother of the first sexiest man in Ireland. Pat Kenny, he's a TV personality.
But
he was the first sexiest man in Ireland.
Oh, my God.
And Frank was his brother. And Frank was good looking, too, and funny as hell. Mm-hmm. So I said to Frank, I said, you take whore, I'll take the other one. Mm-hmm. Pointing to my wife, Joan. Right. But Joan came over to me.
Oh.
So, and she started talking to me about the British healthcare system. And we haven't talked about it since. Now, that's how I met her. Mm-hmm. So I'd fallen head over heels. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't do anything. And I wanted to stay in the country. And she wouldn't marry me. I remember her exact words. She said, "I'm not going to circumvent the Constitution." She said. And so, but anyway, because I was an athlete,
right.
I played Gaelic football, and I got my papers. That was an innocent time. It wasn't like nowadays.
No, I know.
And it was Boston,
yeah,
you know, and
right.
Boston is so Irish.
Yes, oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So then I transferred, I auditioned for Boston University.
You audition. So does that mean that at this point you are thinking of being an actor?
Yeah.
So you auditioned?
They said to me, that Christmas, I do a Child's Christmas in Wales every Christmas, it seems. But that Christmas was the first time someone asked me to read a Child's Christmas in Wales. I didn't even know, I'd never heard of it, Dylan Thomas. But I read it for this gathering, a Christmas thing. And someone afterwards said to me, are you an actor? And I said, no. And they said, well, you should be one. I said, what do you do to be an actor? And they said, you go to school. And I said, where? And they said, well, Boston University has a professional school. So I auditioned.
So now, who is this person? Do you remember?
Yeah, she was doing her master's in costumes at Emerson College.
She was then?
Mm. Yeah.
Well, we owe her.
But anyway... Yeah. So I auditioned, and they didn't know what to make me. They called the first time it had ever happened that they couldn't decide, and they had someone else, two other teachers, professors, look at me, and they said it was great.
Yeah, it's great. He's a natural.
Yeah.
Right.
Bring him in. So I went to, I transferred to BU for 3 years, and I graduated there.
And you've been here ever since.
Yeah.
Well, and now you like people looking at you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you've probably heard that, this rehearsal period was really, really torturous to me, but the the fact that I survived it, and Kate, you know, and Richard were fantastically supportive and everything. And Susan was great, you know.
Susan is. We're talking about Chapati, which is what he is starring in with Susan Greenhill.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of talk about the difficulty because the play didn't open on time.
Yeah, it was delayed a week.
So do you want to say what...
The play is deceptively difficult. The language is extraordinarily... It's a very difficult part to learn. And I worked it out yesterday, I play 14 characters in it.
Oh my God.
You know, and giving them different voices, different...
Right.
But the tremendous support I got, no one said a thing. It was really, they were killing me with kindness, you know. It's like I felt terrible about it, but they said, we're going to support you. We're going to get behind you.
Okay, we're talking about Kate Alexander, who is the director, and Richard Hopkins, who is the artistic director of Florida Studio Theater.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah. And so Richard came into my dressing room once after a preview, and he said, "Will you just act?" He said to me, "No, look, it doesn't matter that you have the script." He said to me, "Fuck the script." He said, "Just act." And you know, and then I don't know how it happened. And now when I look back at it, I don't know what was my problem.
Wow.
You know, what was my fussiness about? What was all that about? Because, touch wood, it's a joy to do.
To do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's perfect for you.
It's, well...
Yeah, you are. You're perfect for it.
Yeah.
It's, I believed you from the minute you stood up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Once you get past that opening monologue,
Oh, the one about howling and laughing.
That's a real, oh God, that's a tricky thing to do. One of the interns here who was running lines with me, Kayla, she said that our two opening monologues, mine and Susan's,
right.
It's like being pushed off a cliff. So,
yeah.
Scary proposition.
Yes, very.
Yeah. But the rest of it is you know, it's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
Yeah.
It is. Do you want to talk a little bit about the play itself?
Well, not only did Richard and Kate, you know, come to my rescue, but everyone else is around too. I mean, the interns were looking forward to the free grub, and the free booze,
right,
at the party.
Right,
you know,
right.
They had to wait a week. You know, and they didn't bitch or moan or anything. Mm-hmm. Like that, so I felt bad about it. But the playwright, Kristen O'Reilly, wrote me.
You're kidding.
Apologizing for writing such a difficult part.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Who ever heard of that?
I've never heard of that.
Wow.
And he said John Mahoney had difficulty too. You know, he's the original.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And whom I knew in passing from my early days in Chicago, Steppenwolf.
Can you pinpoint more directly what is the difficulty? Is it that the words don't make a certain kind of sense? Because when you say them, they certainly do. Or there are... I don't know.
It's to do with sentence construction.
Oh.
And believing in the story. It took me a while to believe in the story, I think.
Ah.
You know? And it's not like I've done a lot of Friel. Brian Friel,
mm-hmm.
And I've done plays that break the fourth wall, you know, I like that sort of stuff. But this, something about Christian's poetic nature is really, really dicey to get. He's talking about stuff that no one else really talks about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're like cats and dogs, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yes.
You know the whole thing, and the cup of tea and the repetition, you know, of lines that we each have.
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing. And have you seen the script?
No, I haven't seen the script.
Well, it's written in verse.
You're kidding.
No. Parts of it are written in verse, and then parts where we talk to each other, the dialogue, is in dialogue, and then in verse. And if it's in verse, Dan is underlined. If it's dialogue, Dan is not underlined. And I wrote back to him, and I told him that I finally, you know, and he said that he, it was a new convention, that he was, that he hadn't, didn't really, it was the only time that he tried that sort of thing.
And he won't do it again.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think it's really successful here. I mean, we found it, you know.
Well, once you find it.
Yeah.
Well, okay. It is a beautiful play. Both of you are wonderful. I mean, it's so moving and so touching, and I love the dog not being there and the cat not being, I love all that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I really believed, I mean, I really saw them.
Yeah.
You know.
Right, yeah.
So.
Well, he's on the cover of the program.
Yes, he is. But I. So, but I mean, yeah. You know.
Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, do you have a dog?
I had two dogs when I was younger.
Yeah, because you looked like you knew how to do that.
No, but that's Kate.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. She, and so specific. Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's funny how these things happen. Like, there used to be a rope.
Oh, really?
Now it's mined, yeah. And it, on the first run-through on stage, I couldn't get it over the beam.
Oh.
I tried about four times, and then I said, I'm miming it.
Yeah, right. It's fine.
And then Richard said...
Yeah, it's perfect, because so much is mimed that it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, that's great. Well, so much isn't there. Not so much that it's mimed, but so much isn't there. I mean, Peggy isn't there, and the dog animals aren't
Peggy's
there.
Peggy's the best character in the play,
yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah,
I mean, she has the real change.
Yeah, she does. She's the one who...
Yeah.
You do, too. Well, yeah, everybody does
but
a little.
Peggy's is remarkable.
Very dramatic, right? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she's so tall.
All for kindness, right? All for kindness.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so how did you get this?
I've worked here before.
You have?
Yeah, ghostwriter.
Oh, God, that's right. I saw you. I forgot.
Yeah.
Wow.
So a friend of mine in New York said, do you know about this play? And I said, no. You should get your...
Yes, you definitely, right.
And then I got in touch with Kate. I said, is there anything for me in this chapati, you know? She said, yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I auditioned, and Susan was the reader.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I said, because I noticed we were all guys, there was no women around in New York at the audition, I said, is the role cast? And she said, I don't know.
Susan said, or you...
Susan said to me, I don't know. I said, is Betty cast? She said, I don't know. And I said it to her. She said, I said, you told me you didn't know, and you're the Betty. And she said, Kate told me to say that. Yeah.
Well, you guys are wonderful. It's really, really wonderful. It's really worth seeing. And it's running until May 30th.
Yes.
Do you know what you're doing after this?
I'd like to stay in Sarasota.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like as in live?
I don't know. But that's from... I usually do Shakespeare, but I don't know, outdoors. In the summer.
Well, we would love to have you.
Yes. I think it's a beautiful place. It's paradise.
Well, I think so too. I only ask one other question.
Sure.
And that is, having spent most of your life as an actor, would you say what that's like?
Well, I've done everything that you can possibly do as an actor. I wouldn't call myself a well-known person. I mean, I'm not well-known. But I have had my name above the title on Broadway. I have starred in movies. I've done everything that's possible to do. I just haven't sustained it, I think. You know? And I've done I've done work that I'm really proud of. That has been well received. So in a way, I had to know. You know, you wouldn't. I'm not Gabriel Byrne, that's for sure. But Susan called me the Liam Neeson of Sarasota. And what more? I mean, what's better than that?
No.
Isn't that right?
Right.
So I'm the Liam Neeson of Sarasota, and that's not bad.
No, it's lovely. And
I've worked with, I've worked with Shelley Winters, which was a trip, and I've worked with Jason Robards.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he and I shared above the title.
Really?
Yeah. On Broadway.
What play?
Molly Sweeney.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I took over from Alfred Molina.
Oh, my goodness. So, do you like being an actor? I mean,
yeah, I love being an actor.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I think it's the only thing I can do well, you know. I think I succeed. I think, why do I, that's a good question. I just love that feeling of being on stage. I just love telling stories, I suppose. I think I'm a pretty good storyteller.
Definitely, you're a pretty good storyteller.
Yeah.
It's a good thing you like it.
Yeah, yeah. And there's nothing like it. There's nothing like the feeling, the feeling of getting it all right. As Rich would say, of breathing into it. As Kate would say, taking the wind in the sails or of the kite and stuff like that. There's nothing like it. And there's nothing like, in this particular play, there's nothing like making people laugh. You know? It's great. And we found it. We've found more humor in this than it's there. I think Susan is real. She's a comic genius.
I know.
Yeah. But what was your question again?
If there's anything you would say about what it means to give a life to acting.
Well, my daughter is in grad school at NYU in the acting program.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a dancer. And she's danced all her life. And from the very get-go, I watched her. She's modern jazz, resting Irish, but she always had this presence on stage. It was always like she'd look out. She had the guts to look straight out, and it looked like she was accusing you of doing something you didn't know what. But it was like saying, it's your fault. And you would find yourself going, no, yes, it is. You know? And I think she's inherited something there, you know? But it's really interesting to see it, to see your reflection up there,
yes.
You know, to see it. And say, Jesus Christ, I know what she's thinking. I know what she's doing.
You know how she's feeling.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think it's the same. It's nothing can compare it to it.
There's nothing to compare to it.
No.
That's a good place to stop. Yeah. Thank you, Colin Lane.
Thanks, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.
Colin says there's nothing else he can do. But he also says there's nothing to compare to the feeling of getting it right, of having the wind in your sails. And when someone describes their work in this way, then what you know is that they are, to use the psychological term, congruent. They are in sync with themselves. What you see is what there is. They are themselves. And as always, I hope that when you listen to someone like Colin, you hear what it sounds like to be congruent, to be yourself, to be the person that you are. And as always, I hope that it is inspiring to you, that it poses the question, is this how I feel about my life? That there is nothing else that I could or would or want to do? That there's nothing like the feeling of doing or being who I am? Are you able to say, I am myself? And even when it's a struggle, as this play was for Colin, even when it's not simple, even when it's not easy, even when it's problematic, I wouldn't do anything else. I want to work my way through this so I can do this. Are you feeling that way about your life? Well, I certainly hope you are. But if you're not feeling that way about your life, Then I hope that you are asking yourself, why not? Why don't I feel this way about my life? And maybe you're remembering what you had to give up, what you had to deny, what about yourself you had to leave behind. And if you are, I hope you are asking the very next question, can I get it back? Can I be me? Can I say about my life that nothing else can compare to this, the life I am living, to being myself? Well, of course, I hope you are. And I hope that you will pursue that by going into therapy or in any other way that you can find, that you will decide to honor yourself. So, before I end this show, I'm going to read Sharon Leslie's review of Chapati. Ah, people and their pets. That's the jumping off point for the regional premiere at Florida Studio Theater's moving production of Chapati by Irish playwright Christian O'Reilly. There is just something about that special place people have in their hearts for their pets. O'Reilly wants us, the audience, to concentrate on the human story and not be distracted by their pets. You know the old standby adage for actors, quote, never work with children or animals, unquote, often quoted by W.C. Fields, with comic Edwin adding, quote, the dog will steal the show, unquote. So, the playwright makes a very interesting decision. No pets are ever seen on stage. No cats, no dogs. Just two characters, Dan and Betty, interacting with unseen pets and humans. Chapati is the name of the cute little dog owned by the character Dan, played with so much appeal by Colin Lane. Chapati is an unleavened flatbread from Southern Asia, India, and the Horn of Africa, kind of like wraps used for sandwiches. The little mongrel was hanging out at an Ethiopian restaurant Dan would frequent with his lady love. When it followed him home, Dan lets the dog stay and gives him the name Chapati after the dish they would often order. To help us see Chapati on stage, a photo of the dog appears on the front of the program and on posters as you arrive. As the story unfolds, we are presented with parallel stories of two lonely pet lovers living in working-class Dublin. Retired laborer Dan has just lost his longtime love to cancer. He talks to his dog, visits the cemetery, and makes unnecessary trips to the local veterinarian. He's thinking of suicide, but first must find a suitable home for his dog, Chapati. Then there is the amiable Betty, played with much charm by Susan Greenhill. The energetic Betty cares for a cranky, sickly, upper-class neighbor whose grown children don't visit her, and whose only company is Prudence, a cat. Betty owns 19 cats, and when one has kittens, she packs them up in a carton and takes them to the same vet that Dan has been visiting. As opposed to Dan, Betty has not given up on life, and despite her self-described drab appearance, she has faint hopes of romance with a man. Their lives collide in an encounter outside the vet's office. In this unlikely and slowly unfolding September romance, Betty is persistent in the midst of Dan's blinding despair. Each sparks in the other the possibility of a relationship, and O'Reilly gives us a story that proves that love can happen anywhere, anytime, with anyone. Director Kate Alexander has given us another production that touches the heart. She pulls out wonderfully drawn emotional moments of human suffering and resilience from her terrific actors. The Irish accents never get so thick that you cannot understand the language. The pantomime with unseen pets are clear, and the blackish comedy is never off-putting. The set by Isabel and Mariah Curley Clay evokes the overall air of the downtrodden but ever-enduring Irish commoner. The costumes by Susan Angerman beautifully define the character, place, and time of the piece. As with many new plays these days, it is performed without an intermission and lasts about an hour and 40 minutes. Mostly, there is nothing better than watching a two-person in the hands of two gifted actors. Susan Greenhill sparkles and purrs as the cat lover Betty, and Colin Lane draws you into the unspoken pain and softly rekindling of the life-affirming fire in Dan. All in all, it's a beautiful evening at the theater. So, if listening to me and Colin talk about Chapati didn't make you want to run right out and see it, then I'm sure that Sharon's reviewed will. And I hope that it does, because it is, as Sharon says, a beautiful evening in the theater. Now, as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you, something that inspired you, something that made you laugh, something that you didn't know that now you know, something that you knew but had forgotten, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten